Mr. Cooper.
Thank you, Your Honor. This appeal comes before the court on this criminal case from Judge Capalla's order below authorizing the Bureau of Prisons to forcibly administer antipsychotic drugs to Mr. Breedlove for the sole purpose of rendering him competent to stand trial or competent to continue
to be
trial.
Sentenced, if I understand it correctly. Already pleaded guilty?
To pick up the trial from the point at which it
He's
ended.
He's already pleaded guilty. There won't be a trial.
I know, he had pleaded guilty. But besides the sentencing, and this is it's no surprise to the government, Mr. Breedlove has from times expressed a wish to file a motion to withdraw his guilty plea. So it's conceivable that other proceedings besides the sentencing could take place. But you're right otherwise, Your Honor, for sentencing. It also is an appeal from Judge Capalla's order denying Mr. Breedlove's motion filed after the conclusion of the cell hearing and after his attorney's withdrawal, his motion to be reevaluated, accompanied by my affidavit indicating that he appeared to be competent. With the court's permission, I would like to begin my argument. I'm prepared to talk on all these points, but I would like to begin my argument with the last point, which is the court's denial of our motion for reevaluation. This comes before the court in an odd posture. We have here the defendant arguing that he is competent, that he is ready to go forward with the trial, whether it be sentencing or something else. And we have the government in opposition to that. The government made no formal response to our motion at the trial level, but on the appeal has argued against it. So it's a somewhat odd posture. We think that Judge Capalla abused his discretion in rather cryptically denying the motion for reevaluation for three reasons. The first is he said that I didn't have any psychological training, just legal training, which is true. But that overlooks the fact that competence is a quintessentially legal issue. It has to do with the defendant's ability to understand the proceedings and to cooperate with his counsel. That phrase, quintessentially legal, is found in the cell case itself in Justice Breyer's opinion. An attorney is in a very good position to determine whether his client is or is not competent to understand and cooperate. The second point is that mental illness, as the Supreme Court recognized in the Drope case, can be a very fluid concept, and it certainly was in this case.
Yeah, isn't that exactly the worry a district court is going to have? Your client says, well, I'm competent now. Some psychiatrist says, yeah, he's competent now. And then when the sentencing comes, he stands up and says, yeah, but I'm not competent today. Ha, ha, ha.
Well, he may not be saying it, ha, 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 Your Honor. It may be the fact that his competence does come and go, and that could be the nature of the mental illness that he has.
If that's what is happening, that sounds like a reason for medication, to ensure that when the time comes for sentencing, he will be competent, rather than keep claiming, I need to be evaluated again, and subtext, you're never going to be able to proceed with his sentencing, because if you think I'm incompetent and need to be medicated, I'll say the opposite. If you think I'm competent, I'll say the opposite.
Your Honor, that could be the case if you have this going on more than it's happened now.
He was competent before. He had to have been competent or he couldn't have been allowed to plead guilty. So we're already in a situation in which he said and the judge found he was competent at the time of his guilty plea. Then he says, I'm incompetent. And there's an evaluation, and he's found to be incompetent. And then we have the wheel come round to the claim, yeah, but I'm competent again now.
Well, let me point out to the court first that it's not Mr. Breedlove saying any of those things. Mr. Breedlove did not file the motion to find him incompetent. His attorney did. Mr. Breedlove has never quarreled with what the psychiatrists say
you've got pretty clear evidence from expert witnesses here. What more evidence do you need?
Well, the evidence from the expert witnesses is that he was incompetent we don't quarrel with that evidence. What we're saying is that, especially given the nature of his delusions, which were in a limited...
Well, the expert witnesses said this other stuff was going to make him confident, didn't it?
That's what they said. That's right. That's a prediction on their part, a psychological prediction,
well,
which may or may
wrong,
not...
wrong, but...
May be wrong. What I'm saying is, when the attorney says, you know, I'm dealing with this guy... He understands exactly what's going on. He is cooperating with me all the way. Shouldn't the court at least give enough credence to that to see whether or not that is the case? Because his mental illness may have dissipated. And the last point I want to make on this is there's a very good reason to think that it could have dissipated in this case. Because the focus of his mental illness was his belief that his attorney was in cahoots with the government and conspiring against him, Mr. Nelson. Mr. Nelson, right before the cell hearing, withdrew or was discharged. Actually, it was both. So he was out of the picture, more wrong. And Mr. Nelson said at the time he thought he should be out of the picture because it would give Mr. Breedlove one less thing to fixate upon with respect to this. It is extremely, it just seems to me, entirely possible, and the court should have taken this into account, to think that Mr. Nelson's exit from the case may have relieved Mr. Breedlove's fixation on that and may, in fact, have gotten rid of the delusional problems that were interfering with his ability to cooperate with Mr. Nelson. That's enough, it seems to me, for the court to have...
Is there any expert support for the contention that delusions will go away on a change of lawyers?
Not on a change of lawyers, but if you have a delusion which is centered on the fact that the lawyer, the belief that the lawyer is conspiring against him and the lawyer is out of the picture and no longer involved in the case, it would seem to me that
Look,
should be enough.
I wish you would answer my question. Is there any expert support for the belief, which you are now asserting as fact, that a change of lawyers will affect the delusional activity?
I know of no psychological reports that say that or no legal cases that say that, Your Honor.
What lawyers believe about that isn't relevant. You're giving us a proposition of psychiatric fact, and I wondered if you've had any basis for it.
No, I guess I don't, other than common sense, Your Honor, if it can...
Lawyers' common sense may have no relation whatever to actual findings about mental diseases.
But, Your Honor, I would argue
that's why you went to law school rather than medical school.
But I would argue, Your Honor, that in the legal issue of competence, no one is in a better position to judge a client's competence than the lawyer who's representing him. And it is
that
a legal question.
That strikes me as transparently false.
Oh, well, then you and I just disagree on that, Your Honor. If I might now, I would like to turn to the cell issues.
The idea that criminal defense lawyers are good psychiatrists is ridiculous.
I don't think I'm saying I'm a good psychiatrist.
You said that no one is in a better position than the criminal's lawyer to figure out his psychiatric condition. And
I did not say that. I did not say that, Your Honor. I said no one is in a better position to figure out his competence, which is a legal question, not a psychiatric question. Psychiatry certainly bears on it, but it is a legal question. And a lawyer is certainly in the best position to do that. Every time that we do pleas before Judge Coppola, we are always asked if we have any reason to believe that our client is incompetent. And if lawyers are not any judge of that, why is Judge Coppola asking that question? But I do not want to argue with the court.
That's a good question.
Let me move on to the cell issues. The first element in the cell issue is whether or not the government's interest is sufficiently important to forcibly medicate someone. The first point I would make on that is cell itself does not say whether it applies to crimes against anything other than crimes against person or property. Cell says it applies for serious crimes against person, serious crimes against property. It does not say. It is true that other circuits have held that it can apply to crimes which are not crimes against persons or property, and in particular, I suppose, drug transactions. Cell itself does not say that. We would argue that victimless crime, there should be a distinction made between victimless crimes and crimes with victims.
Even a victimless crime with a maximum punishment of life in prison?
Yes.
Your assessment that no one is a loser from this crime is obviously not Congress's assessment.
Congress's assessment is that drug cases, for instance, can range in penalty from probation to life in prison. So their assessment, in my view, is that some can be unimportant and some can be important. They don't decide the particular cases. Our argument is that the victimless crimes do not, in fact, implicate one of the primary purposes of criminal prosecution, which is to vindicate some particular the violation of some particular individual's rights to security in his person or property, and that that's missing.
What's the logic of that? What would be the logic of that?
The logic would be simply what I've stated, is that there's a significant difference when you don't have a victim. Your Honor, I don't consider this to be the strongest part of my argument. Oh. And if the court please, I would like to move on to the next part of it. Mm-hmm. But unless I don't mean to interrupt, though, Your Honor.
That's all right. Go ahead.
Now the question becomes, what about the maximum penalty? Is the maximum penalty, should that be determinative of the government's interest? The first observation to make on that point is this. There is a very strong tension between saying that the maximum penalty in and of itself determines the importance of the government's interest, and the statement in Sell, the direction to the courts in Sell, that the decision regarding the government's interest should be decided on with consideration to the facts of the individual case. It seems to me that if the only fact you have to look at is what's the maximum penalty, theoretical maximum penalty, you're not deciding a matter on the facts of the individual case, which is what Sell says you should do. Here, the court this court had a great deal of information in front of it to decide the importance of the government's interest, not in prosecuting drug crimes generally, but in continuing to prosecute Mr. Breedlove. He had Mr. Breedlove's plea agreement. He had heard Mr. Breedlove testify at trial, and he had his pre-sentence report by that time. He could have decided, based on all of that, whether Breedlove's was an important enough actor here to justify injecting him with these dangerous drugs simply to make him competent. But most importantly,
are they really dangerous? I thought they used them to cure the problem.
They do. Dangerous is a strong statement, I will concede. They do have dangerous side effects that can occur in a certain number of cases, and that was conceded by the expert witnesses at the trial. Mm-hmm. Here, though, the fact is that the court knew and acknowledged what the sentence was going to be. It was going to be 10 years. And our point is that in this case, at least, the court should not say it's the maximum sentence of life when the government has effectively quantified what it believes the importance is by agreeing to a sentence of 10 years, and the court has acknowledged that that's the likely sentence. So we think determining the government's interest, the importance of the government's interest, this court should adopt a rule that the court should take into account all of the circumstances of the case, as Sell says, so far as they are known, including but not limited to the likely sentence, and that likely sentence should be based on the best available evidence. In this case, the best available evidence was very strong.
And 10 years is not serious?
Well, I will say that most of the cases, as I read them, are against me on this point and would probably imply that 10 years in and of itself would be serious enough. The government's brief does point out a case, the Hernandez-Vasquez case, in a footnote on page 39 of their brief, in which the maximum was 20 years and the guideline range was 92 to 115 years, so slightly under that, and they remanded that case for determination of importance. Some slight, I think, basis, some slight support for my position, but I will concede to the court that the bulk of the cases seem to imply that 10 years would be important. My point is that Breedlove, the court had sufficient evidence to show that Breedlove was not a very important player that should have come
in. And this was an 11C1C agreement, was it not?
It was, yes, yes. Then there are the Sixth Amendment cases that the government relies on, the Blanton case, which says that we should adopt as the rule in determining importance. Am I over my time limit?
Your time has just expired.
Wow. Okay. Then I will rely on my brief.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The District Court committed no error in ordering the involuntary medication of the defendant because it made findings with respect to each of the four factors the Supreme Court identified in Sell against the United States. And those findings were supported by substantial evidence that included the uncontradicted testimony of both a psychiatrist and a psychologist who personally examined the defendant, made an individualized assessment of his condition, and proposed a very specific treatment plan for the court in requesting authorization to do this treatment. With respect to the first factor under Sell, the two offenses, both a drug offense and a gun offense, to which the defendant pleaded guilty are undoubtedly serious. They are punishable by a sentence of life in prison, up to life imprisonment, and they also have mandatory minimum sentence of 10 years with respect to the drug case and 5 years with respect to the gun case. So under no conceivable understanding could those two offenses be thought, according to Congress's judgment or any other judgment, not to be a serious offense. With respect to the second prong, the two medical experts who testified, again without contradiction, indicated that the treatment that they proposed, the administration of haloperidol, was substantially likely to render the defendant competent and that any side effects that would occur or could occur through that administration could be managed and would not interfere with his ability to assist counsel. With respect to the necessity prong under Sell, the testimony was that there were no other viable treatment protocols available for the defendant. Both experts testified that therapy or counseling or some non-invasive treatment was not likely to be successful. There was no evidence suggested that either of those alternatives would be viable in this case, and the order that the district court entered required that the medical officials at Butner use the least intrusive measure to administer the drugs, including the testimony that they would first offer the defendant the opportunity to take the drugs orally before it was administered by injection. And finally, the experts testified consistently that the administration of the drugs were medically appropriate, that if a member of the community were faced with the same diagnosis, that this is the same treatment they would recommend to somebody who is not incarcerated, that it would improve their overall health, that it would help the defendant by relieving these fixations that interfered with unrelated health issues, for example, his unwillingness to take cholesterol medication. And Dr. Reardon, in particular, testified about the benefit that the defendant would have from the administration of these drugs when she said, quite powerfully, that I would not want to suggest that suffering from a mental illness isn't just that, it is suffering, and that these drugs would relieve that form of suffering. With respect to the defendant's request for reevaluation that counsel raised today, the district court was entitled to rely upon the testimony of the three experts, the two who testified at the Sell hearing, as well as the expert who submitted a written report to the court when the finding of incompetence was first made. And the motion for reevaluation, I just note, came merely 3 weeks after the Sell hearing, at which the two experts, the psychologist and the psychiatrist, both testified in the presence of the defendant by video teleconference about his condition. And there was no evidence in that hearing suggesting that spontaneous improvement of the defendant's condition was a possibility. Just the contrary, the testimony was that absent treatment, his prognosis was continued cognitive decline. And the report also indicates that the delusions from which he suffered were not limited to simply delusions with respect to the role of the one attorney who withdrew, but there are suggestions in the report that he was amenable to believes that he had been brainwashed by satellite surveillance, that people were putting things into his food, that he was receiving other medical treatment without knowledge. And so on the record that the district court had before it, there was no error or no abuse of discretion, certainly, in denying the request for additional treatment. Subject to any questions the court might have, we would ask that you affirm the district court.
Thank you very much. Mr. Cooper, the court appreciates your willingness to accept the appointment and your assistance to your client and the court alike. Thank you. The case is taken under advisement. Case number 4 for argument this morning.